obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, I'm Vito and I'm an alcoholic. And welcome everyone to our second annual AA Veteran Speaker Meeting. Thank you, Dave. It's great to see you here, and thank you for letting me do this for the last 2 years. I'm going to get right to it. I'm going to tell you right now, we're breaking a little bit of the traditional format for roundup speaker meetings where we have one speaker and lots of readings. If you need to hear the readings, they're selling big books right outside of the door. We're going to do a few, but I'd rather have, last year we were lucky enough to have still with us two longtime sober World War II veterans that were at the head table because I wanted to have vets from every war possible since AA was formed. That was the first war after that would have been World War II. And I was lucky enough to run into these two lovely people on either side of me. And what we decided to do this year, while they're still with us, is give them 10 minutes each to share. And then we'll bring on our main speaker after that. So it's going to be a little bit different format, but I'm sure it's going to be a great deal. So I'm really looking forward to it. Having said that, I'd like to introduce our head table on my right, your left, at the far end, representing our Al-Anon veterans, Les W. I don't know. Next to Les, also representing our female Al-Anon veterans, Sandy K. Next is a U.S. Navy veteran, retired from the U.S. Navy after like 20 plus years of service, I think, right, Kat? 25 years of service. Kathy C. She'll be reading the closing prayer. Next, we have our speaker host for this evening. He's a U.S. Army veteran from the Vietnam era, Jim G. Next to Jim is our main speaker for tonight, and Jim will tell you a lot more about him. But our main speaker, let's welcome RBA from San Clemente. Next, I have a guy up here that is not a veteran, and I'll explain why I have him up here. I try to keep the head table all veterans. I've known this gentleman for years. He's been sober a long time, and he was a main speaker at American Martyrs a couple months ago, and part of his story was that he has a son. He got a call while he was at the men's stag at Roxbury one night. He got a call from the Department of Defense that his son was critically injured in Iraq and lost his legs, and the guys from Roxbury surrounded him, stayed with him that night, got him to the airport the next day, and they flew him into Germany so he could meet up with his son, and he brought his son back to Walter Reed. And since then, he's been very, very involved in helping develop and involved with the Wounded Warrior Association. So John C. is a Wounded Warrior guy and a Semper Fi guy. So welcome, John C. And next to him, our soon-to-be, still 97, but soon-to-be 98, beautiful friend of mine from Yucca Valley. He's a World War II vet. He was one of these guys that drove the Gibson boats. And if you don't know what they are, they're the boats that, during the D-Day invasion, there were the boats that you saw in Saving Private Ryan where the front ends dropped down and the troops run out, and the troops had to dodge all that fire once. Jimmy was out there all day running guys back and forth from the battleships to the shore, and he's a decorated hero, and he won't tell me what his medals are because he said all he wants to do is be sober. Jimmy S., I almost used his last name, from Yucca Valley. On this side of the podium, another one of my wonderful discoveries in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had her up here last year to introduce the speaker, and I went to a Wednesday Torrance 1 o'clockers to meet her, and she just knocked my socks off. She's so fun, and she's got a great story, and she's been sober a long time. She's the grandmother to all the girls at House of Hope, and she's an original wave from World War II. Helen G. from San Pedro. Yeah. Next to Helen, Helen's speaker host, and who will introduce her, a U.S. Navy veteran, Tony L. from Rancho PV. Did I have that right? Next, we have a guy that's been real important to my sobriety. He's the chief guru of my home group and longtime sober guy, a U.S. Air Force veteran from the Vietnam era, Clayton B. He'll be reading chapter 3. Next to him, another guy that's been an important cog in my sobriety for as long as I can remember. Used to live in El Segundo, now lives in the Escondido area. He's a U.S. Coast Guard veteran from the Korean War era, Bill C. And if any of you guys are familiar with the South Bay Alano Club, there's a fixture there that comes with the lights. And that's the guy on the end of the table, a U.S. Army Vietnam era veteran, Everett K. Having said that, they want me to read the preamble, so here goes. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. And before we get started, I was going to do this a little later, but the room is pretty full already. This is a veterans meeting. It's honoring our sober veterans from whatever country. It just so happens we're in the United States, so probably the majority of our veterans are U.S. military veterans. But if you're a veteran of any armed forces service ever, please stand up right now, please. Look around you and thank these guys. All right. I hope that gives you a chill. That's where the idea for this meeting came from, when we were standing up for years, and I'm going, oh, wow, man. This is just great stuff. So thank you, guys. Thank you for your service. And now, without any further ado, let's get on with our meeting to introduce our first speaker, John C.
Good afternoon. My name is John Carnes. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to welcome all those new people here. You'll find hope and love. It's quite an honor to read this list of accomplishments in one man's life. Our first speaker will be Jimmy S. from Yucca Valley. He was born June 6, 1916. He is the oldest sober World War II vet with 40 years of sobriety plus, and in just a few days he'll be celebrating 41 years. He's a United States Navy veteran. He's been awarded 6 medals, which will remain anonymous, but although it did take them 55 years to get them. He was on Normandy at Utah Beach. He was part of the amphibious landing crafts that brought everybody ashore. And he was actively in duty from 1943 to 1945. He left the Navy as a boatsman gunner, second class. He entered the reserves after that for 18 years. And if it hadn't been for a thing called alcoholism, he would have made it to 20. He was so close. He was doing such a good job. He tried to convince me that he actually crossed the Atlantic with Queen Mary, but I later found out it was a boat. One of the things Jimmy and I have in common is a love of breaking the law. Jimmy ran book in New York in the 30s, and he did that for quite a while until at the age of 27 he entered the military. After that, he moved to California in 1948. He did the other thing that we like to do. We like to drive trucks and, you know, tell stories and find women all over the world that we can convince that we're somebody that we're not. And just like myself, he loves to sell. Jimmy's been, you know, a really wonderful man to talk to, because, you know, if you talk to him, you can see where Alcoholics Anonymous has given him a life that's just amazing. It didn't stop there. He took this life, just like it talks in the book, and he spread it into every place he's gone. He is, without a doubt, one of the most loving, caring, kindest men I've ever met. And if you would, please welcome Salvador Vincenzi. I'm going to blow this. Okay, Sortino. And let's give him a big round.
Well, he's going to stand. We had his mic set up, but he wants to stand up here.
Jimmy Sortino, alcoholic. Oh, a few. Story of my life. First of all, I want to thank my wonderful and loving dear friend, Dave. I'm glad to see him here right now in our midst, because I was unsure whether I would be able to see him ever again from what I heard. So here he is, that smiling face of his, and thank God for that. I wish I could say what I want to talk about. I want to talk about my sobriety. Is that what I'm supposed to do?
Yes.
Well, it's been so long ago, I don't remember. We'll start from the beginning. When I came into this program, I came in not as a person that wanted to stay sober, but I had been arrested 9 times. And this time I thought, well, maybe I can get away with this again this time. But I had 9 arrests. And when they took me to court, the judge asked the prosecuting attorney to make sure they got my records. And when I went for my arraignment, they couldn't find one. I mean, I couldn't believe that. I was insulted. I said, don't they know who I am? You know, 9 arrests, don't they know who I am? So I says, well, I really felt bad. I said, these guys ain't playing the game right. So I went ahead and he gave me 36 months probation. So he had me pay $350. And then I had to write to him. I never heard of such a thing, to write to the judge personally. I had to write to him every month for the 3 years that I was given this wonderful penance. So I stopped writing to the man, and when I was writing him about a year and a half later, I noticed what the man's name was. It was a four-letter word, not with the F and the K, you know, but it was L-O-V-E. Judge L-O-V, Judge Love. I fell down to my knees and I start crying. I says, this can't be possible. This can't be possible. Well, I get up from my knees and I start working this program. I've worked this program to the best of my ability. I've sponsored many of men who I love and they love me back. I don't know what else to say because I'm gonna start crying, which I don't mind doing because my eyes are blurring, and I so how much time do I have? So, well, anyway, I became very an avid person with I sponsored a bunch of guys. I still do. I still go to meetings. I'll be 58 next month. I mean, 58. Gee whiz, thank you. Excuse me. I'll be, what? 98. Thank you. You are listening. So, well, but what I want to say is, you know, I love you people. I love each and one of you in this room and then every room that I walk into. I have a wonderful wife here. This is my second marriage. My first wife I was married to for 47 years, and she passed away. And when I got to the age where I said, well, I don't want to live my life alone, So I searched, and I found this wonderful lady who lives in Yucca Valley, and I moved there. And I've been ever there since then, and I've loved it up there. It's been a beautiful place to be. I'm going to wish you all a happy, beautiful day. I'm going to give up my speech here today because I have no more to say except I love you. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you, Jimmy. And when he tells you he loves you, every time I see him, the first thing out of his mouth, I'll say, I love you, Jimmy. And he'll go, I love you more, man. And he's the one guy I never argue with about that because he's got total love in his heart. Okay, now to introduce our second speaker, Tony L.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
My name is Tony, and I'm an alcoholic. I served in the Navy from 1980 to 1984 as a cryptologic technician interpretive. We're better known as spooks, is what we are. And it, you know, it's my great pleasure to introduce my friend, my fellow former GI gal, Helen G., your next speaker. And Helen served in the Navy during World War II, from 1943 to 1945. She was.
Who's counting?
She's a radio man, third class, first stationed at Corpus Christi, Texas, and then transferred to Pensacola, Florida. Helen was among the first women to ever serve the U.S. military outside of the nurse's role. They were designated as WAVES, an acronym for Women Accepted as Volunteers in an Emergency, the emergency being World War II. And, you know, it was applied, it was implied that, you know, after the war was over, that this designation would no longer exist. Due to their exemplary service, along with the service of our WACs during the war, women gained permanent status in 1948. Helen got sober in 1979. She now continues in her longtime service to her pride and joy, the House of Hope. Please help me welcome Helen G.
Is it alive? Hello? Do you hear me? Okay, my name's Helen. I'm an alcoholic. Tony, thank you for the introduction above and beyond. I was one of the first waves, and it wasn't easy, but we managed. Before I go any further, I want to thank Cheryl and Gary, are you here? There they are, for my Navy wave hat. It's the same hat we wore during World War II. Not the same one, but like it. I'll correct that. I also want to thank the people in the room that I can't thank individually. I see you, Carol. for being here and supporting me. I really need a lot of support. And oh my God, my other son, David, showed up. Thank you, David. I adore you. And you know that. Have I left anybody out? Oh, there's Marvin M. I see you. It's so great to look out and see Jerry McDonald came in, and he's doing a great job, as usual. But I digress, which I tend to do. I will get on with the fact that I'm 94 years old, and it's pretty goddamn obvious I can't stand up like Jimmy. He's showing off. I probably led a harder life than he did. Love you, Jimmy. If he wasn't married, I'd go after him. Anyway, I obviously can't tell my whole story. You just don't have the time to listen. You'd be here all night. But I decided I'd take a hunk out of it and share it with you. And the hunk that I'm taking out is I went to my first AA meeting in January 1955. Most of you weren't even born yet. And what I remember of that meeting, and it's funny that I remember it so well, there were a bunch of old men up there sharing about where they hid their bottles. Now, I am quite sure at that meeting they were sharing their stories and more about their sobriety. But what I heard in my twisted, sick, alcoholic mind was that we only hear what we want to hear. We just throw away the rest. And I kept thinking, they just want to find their bottles and drink them. That's their problem. I mean, I was, oh God, was I a sick alcoholic. That followed 12 and a half years of relapsing. I was the queen of relapse. I thought that was real cute. In and out of the program, different periods of sobriety, sometimes 3 months, sometimes 2 months, sometimes a week, sometimes 2 weeks. It didn't matter, in and out, in and out. And I remember one time I was coming off a drunk and my husband said, Helen, you have to go back to AA. And I said, no, I cannot go back in those rooms and raise my hand as a newcomer again. Too embarrassing. He said, AA, Helen, is for the sick alcoholic. If they're not, they better close their doors. You are a sick alcoholic. You have to go back. And so I went back. Then there was another time that my dear darling husband said, I'm going to go to Al-Anon. They'll help me. And I thought, oh crap, the party is over. So he went to Al-Anon, and he would come home and look at me and say, Helen, I know what they're saying, I get the message, but I can't do it. Thank you. He was a hopeless codependent. He went there a couple times. Now, along the way, every time I would go back to drinking, I would tell my husband, I promise you, this time is going to be different. This time I will control it. this time I know I'll make it. So he would say, okay, try it again. Well, you all know what happened. This time it got worse. Every time I went out, it got worse. I ended up taking a survey of the jails in Southern California. I'm here to tell you, stay out of Santa Ana. Man, they were really mean. Oh, cruel. Anyway, I also was doing a survey of the psychiatric units and the mental hospitals. Toward the end of my drinking, I was going to a doctor, Dr. Timmons, rest his soul, who was really compassionate and very interested in trying to get me sober, to the point where he put me through a couple of shock treatments. Ever had a shock treatment? Probably not. They wire your head and you blast out. They throw the electricity to you. I remember the one time my friend Sue came to see me after the shock treatment, and I said, you know, Sue, nobody has come. I have been here for weeks and nobody has bothered to come see me. She said, Helen, your room has been packed with visitors. Everybody from AA came to see you. You were, you know, I had no memory of it. Blank. So maybe my brain is still a little damaged, probably is. But I do remember most things today, except names. I'm terrible at names. Along the way, I also, toward the end, my husband was alternating me. He was too embarrassed to take me to the same place every time. So he would take me to the Long Beach Memorial Psychiatric Unit or the old House of Hope in Long Beach, back when it used to be a summer camp. They had no program, just fun and games down there. At least we made it fun and games. It all just kept getting worse. You told me it would if I went back out, and I kept going back out. By the end of my drinking, I was a non-functioning mother of four children. I was just hopeless, absolutely hopeless. I remember one time toward the end of my drinking, I called the Torrance Police Department and said, come and get me. I am a terrible mother, I'm drunk, and I need to be put in jail. They were very accommodating. They came right over. And they got me and put me in a cell till my husband and I got home, and he came and got me and brought me home again. Anyway, it was not fun. I remember my friend Sue used to say to me, you know, they think we're having fun, and we're not. And we weren't. We were just... The funny thing about Sue, I have to mention, we never got drunk at the same time because we knew we always had to take the other one. I had to take her bottles and she had to bring me bottles. And that's the way we worked it. So we kept supplied. I will get to the day when I was being tapered by my husband with beer. Oh, I forgot. Short-term memory. At the end, subconsciously, he pulled an Al-Anon on me. What he said, he told me, he said, Helen, I've watched you. You've really tried to stop drinking, and you really can't. So I have decided to live around you as a drinking alcoholic. I will bring you all the booze you want. Tell me what you want, what you need, I will bring it. And, you know, when you're ready to taper, I'll taper. Anyway, we went into this program. I thought, hallelujah. oh, the thing I couldn't do was drive a car. No more driving a car. He would bring me the booze, but I couldn't drive. I thought, hallelujah, at last. At long last, I'm going to get what I want. I think that lasted about 3 months. During that 3 month period, I finally got it. It wasn't him. It wasn't the kids. It wasn't the dog. It wasn't his mother that made me drink. Guess who? It was me, picking up the bottle, putting it to my lips, and drinking it. That was the problem. I reached the point the one day I came out to the kitchen, sat at the kitchen counter, sat by the telephone, and what did I remember? I remembered the first woman who called on me from AA. And I remember what she said. She said, Helen, you have to have a higher power. It can be anything that you choose, but you have to believe in that higher power. If you can believe in a higher power, it will work. And I sat and looked at that telephone, and I thought, okay, Marge, I will try to believe in that telephone, because I know it works. I don't know how it works, but I know it works. And I prayed to that telephone, and I asked the telephone to give me the courage to change. I became willing that morning to have anything, to do anything, to not pick up a drink. I remember thinking, if they want to tattoo AA on my forehead, it's okay. If they want to, okay. I didn't look at my watch, David. If they want to tattoo the AA on my forehead, if they want to chain me to the bed and set up a 24-hour watch, it's okay. Whatever it took to make me not pick up the drink. Now, all of you in the room know that it didn't take any of that. When I surrendered, when I turned my life and my will over to the care of the General Telephone Company or whoever it was at that point in time, it worked. The obsession to drink was gone. My husband came in from the garage and he looked at me and said, oh my God, you look like hell. I'll go down and get you your beer. I heard myself say, for the first time in my life, no thanks, I don't want to drink. I couldn't believe it was me. Now, I want you all in this room to know that I have an undying gratitude and love for the fact that you stood by me as those years went by, as I came in and out. You greeted me with love and compassion, and you just were more than I could ever dream from human beings. I will love you all from the bottom of my heart until the day that I check out, which might be any time now. but I keep waking up, and I keep thanking God for another day, every day of my life. But I want you all to know what you mean to me and how wonderful this veteran meeting is. And Jimmy, you're something else. I love you.
And I love you too.
And with that, I will say good night.
I'm not going to deal with it.
obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
You guys may have just witnessed the first 90-plus 13-step. I'm not sure, but... I don't know. Is Jimmy's wife out here? Better pay attention, honey. You know, I'm kidding. I noticed some people hanging in the back. If you have empty seats next to you, please raise your hand so people can see the seats. If you guys want to come up and grab some seats, come up and join the meeting, please. Okay, thank you, Helen. Thank you again. Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you. And now Jim's going to come up and introduce our main speaker for tonight, or for today.
Hi, everybody. My name's Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. And I have no idea what a drunk like me is doing up here. I'm nervous as all you know what. I'm glad you two ended on a friendly note because I was worried about standing between you. You know, if all the veterans in the house could please stand up for me. One more time. Or if you can't stand, please just raise your hand. Come on, guys. And I ask all of you this because I know in America, 22 veterans commit suicide every day. And I have these bracelets that I pass out, and I don't want this to sound like it's about me. This is all about you guys, all of us. I don't know of those 22 guys every day that commit suicide. I don't know how much alcohol is involved, but I would suspect that a great deal of it is. You know, there's one group of men that I ask all of you guys to stand up for that really touched me the most, and that's the Vietnam-era men. And I'm not taking anything away from anybody else. Anybody else that's been in combat or in the military knows exactly what I'm talking about. These Vietnam veterans weren't welcome when they came home. Our country spit on them and called them baby killers and ugly things like that. And I remember I wasn't very proud of the uniform that I wore at the time I wore it. And tonight I get to sit next to a gentleman that's bringing out something that makes me very proud to say I was in the Army. Is anybody recon? Anybody here recon? Yeah, we got one guy in the house. So I never did get to get a CIB. But I met RB tonight, and I noticed that he has a CIB with the star. And that means he's done two different wars. A CIB is a combat infantry badge. And that's like the Holy Grail next to a combat medic's badge or whatever branch you were in. He's also a Bronze Star recipient twice. That's with cluster. He's still active duty. I know his son has been injured. And, you know, that's a great deal of sacrifice that he's put out for our country, and all of us have as well. So getting back to the bracelets, I don't want to fumble this. This is really important to me on the bracelets. If everybody could please just help me welcome them home, all the veterans home. So when I say three, just everybody at the top, no sissy la la stuff, okay? At the top of your lungs, just say welcome home. Okay, please help me with this. The guys that commit suicide, that's their big problem, is they don't feel welcome back when they come home. And that's really dear to my heart, and I know it's very touching to all of us vets. So one, two, three. Welcome home! RB, Alexander from San Clemente, California.
I'm RB, an alcoholic.
Well, you know, it seems like yesterday, but it wasn't. I was in a terribly hot, dusty LZ in Tainan province, and a colonel was pinning an ARCOM on me and my second Bronze Star. And he said, "You really ought to consider staying in the service, Lieutenant Alexander. With your record, you're going to make general." And I remember seeing his lips move, but see, I had reached the point where, thank God, my first sergeant, I had the thousand-yard stare. I was combat ineffective. And he pulled me out. I would have been killed on my next mission. You know, I'd had 10.5 months of straight combat. But he said, "You know, some of the heroic things you've done," and I thought, and I'm in this stupor, I said, "Hero, that's it. I'm not a loser, I'm a hero." And that all went into a blank. Now, fast forward 3.5 decades. I'm outside Sauter City, sitting in the back of an M2 Bradley. We're going in on an agency report, what's called a snatch mission, with 6 Bradleys, 2 M1A1s, and a Kiowa Warrior. And I'm there at the express request of Colonel Velasquez, because I still carry current EOD certs. And we went out on that mission that day and went and searched 5 areas, 5 homes in Sauter City. And it turned out to be a dry hole. So we went to exfil. And as we're back in the Bradley, a lady runs out into the center of these hovels in Sauter City, and she starts yelling something. And the terp goes, and the sergeant asks the terp, "What's she saying?" And he goes, "It is nothing. It is nothing. We must go." Now, this sergeant, York of all things, fires that interpreter on the spot, gets another interpreter, stops the mission, calls Colonel Velasquez. We put in a perimeter. We went out. I hid behind the Bradley. And he asked that woman through the interpreter, "What did you say?" And she says, "The Americans stole my gold." And he gets this and he goes, "Ma'am, I'm an American soldier. I will not steal from you." We returned to the area we had searched, and we had tossed her place, and the drawers were all pulled out. Now, on the floor in this terribly depressing little building were 3 golden rings. Sergeant York picked up those rings and handed back to the lady. That lady said, "The man you're looking for is over there." Now, I saw that, and that's what you guys represent. That is the true history of an American soldier, all of us. That is the spirit of why the war turned in our direction from Anbar province out. From there, I was going to Fallujah, and from there, I went to the Athol Palace, where General Metz, General Petraeus, and General Howerson sat me down in Saddam's, one of his 65 palaces, and they sat me down in the throne room and gave me an exact replica of my cav hat that I lost in a fight in Vietnam by making a comment about the accuracy of the United States Navy and their F-4s. And they called me today and asked me that I wear this, and I will, in honor of all of them. But the key is, I have a problem, and I'm getting over it, when someone says Happy Memorial Day. Because it's not a Happy Memorial Day to me. Memorial Day is the kickoff of summer, hot dogs, and every water game. But it's not. To those of us in this room, it's names, it's faces, it's brothers, it's sons that gave the ultimate sacrifice for this country. And that is why this alcoholic is so proud to be here, because together this country is far more alike than it is different. And I'd like to ask, World War II vets, raise your hand. God, the greatest generation. What about guys during the Korean conflict? You guys didn't get a real great deal either. Okay, Vietnam guys. Anybody from Gulf One? Yeah. How about OIF and OEF? Any of those guys here? All right. That's what it's about. Lynn Wilder is my sponsor. Are you here, Lynn? Could you raise your hand? Interestingly enough, Lynn is one of the only people living that fought in the Revolution. And he made a deal with General Washington. He almost was on the cover, but he settled for the eye. And he's had that eye on me for 35 years. From the first breath I drew until right now, Alcoholics and Alcoholics Anonymous has been the common denominator of my life. My first 29 years of life, alcohol was the single heartbreaking part of my life. I come from a long line of dead drunks. My dad died in his 40s of alcoholism. His dad died in his 40s of alcoholism, and his father before him. Single child, only child, Catholic, Irish. I mean, if you need any more markers, I don't know how you're going to get them. You know, I was sent to Catholic school for some slight behavioral problems in the first grade. And in the third grade, Sister Michael Godzilla took me aside and said, you know, you're not going to be a fourth grader. And so my dad came up half in the bag and took me out of Our Lady of Perpetual Revenge and put me into Newport Elementary, where my older brother, my half-brother Mike, who was the, you know, my hero, said, you know, you better start dating girls or people will talk. And I didn't know what they'd talk about. I only knew one girl, so I asked Judy to go to see The Wizard of Oz, and her mom drove, and, you know, through thick and thin, we dated in elementary school, junior high school, and in high school, she wouldn't have a thing to do with me. She said my intentions were less than honorable. But we kept bumping into each other. But I was an alcoholic from the get-go. And I swore I'd never be like my dad and my mom. And yet, as 8 years old, I walked across the street to play with David Plumb. And I was about to knock on the door. And I heard his mom say, you can't play with the Alexander kid. They're alcoholics. So I went down to the pier, and, you know, and cried. But it went on, and we got evicted out of that house, and we got evicted out of every house we ever lived in. And when I was in high school, we were just going into high school, and we got evicted again, moved to West Newport, and a guy came up, saw us moving in, and asked if I knew how to surf. And I was, you know, from Newport, and I didn't know how to surf at all, but of course I said, you bet I know how to surf. And we took those surfboards down to the river jetty, and I chased that surfboard all day long and never stood up on it. You know, and from now until, you know, from that day until now, surfing's been the single most important part of my life, as far as my spiritual connection with God has come from the ocean. But I went on and acted out. And my very first drunk was as a sophomore in high school. My friends were juniors, had a driver's license. But I grew up with that shame that I didn't fit. I learned to surf a year behind all the rest of my friends. So I was the resident kook. And I'm a pretty good sport, but I try to be at least average in the sports I take up, or I won't take them up. And this guy, Mike K, said, hey, we're going to get together this weekend. My parents are going to La Jolla, and we're going to get drunk. So we had a week to collect alcohol from Tuesday till that Friday night. And I had my parents were drinking gin at the time, and I took this jelly jar and took a little bit of gin and took a little too much, I guess, because I went into my room and heard them fighting. And I came back the next minute, and there was a little tiny nick on the bottle. And as to become a bottle nicker later, I realized that I had taken too much. And when that night finally came, Friday night, all my friends lit their cigarettes up. I never smoked. And they had all kinds of beer that you open with a can opener. One guy had a bottle of Chianti that really gave him hell later in the night as he's trying to time that drink. And I had this jelly jar full of gin, and I took the top of that off, took a swallow, and the top of my head flew off. And I said, boy, I got to trade this. This is no good. But as you guys heard Clancy talk, it went boom. You know, and all of a sudden, I wasn't just part of this crowd. I was taller, handsomer. I was funnier. some of the jokes I told. In fact, I might be the leader of this group. And that night we went across about 11 o'clock, maybe 12, to get my surfboard and some others out of my, we lived across Pacific Coast Highway, Newport Shores. And there's six drunk teenagers trying to be quiet going down the alley. Guys are writing their name and the trash can's falling. And it was off. It was off to the races. And I go to pull my one of the surfboards out, and it falls on my mom's Corvair. And out comes my dad, not a very good athlete, not in good shape. I could outrun him any day, but not that night. And my mom opens up the screen and goes, Bruce, RB's drunk, because I'm staggering around. And along comes this guy, Kerry. I think he's going to save me. It turns out it was his surfboard that I was dragging in the street. He grabs the surfboard, boom. I wake up the next morning with a hole in my stomach that was to stay with me for most of my adult life. My bed, somebody had spilled something in my bed. I knew I was in deep trouble and did not understand why, but I knew I had screwed up and I could only remember, so I'd gone into a blackout. Now, I walked out of there. I got my act together as much as I could, and I walked out of that front room. My mom was waiting till I heard my mom leave, and I knew my dad was going to stop me and go, son, I love you too much to let you go any further. We need to talk. And he was sitting behind the newspaper fighting his own disease, and I walked right by him, and I mumbled something like, sorry about last night, Dad. And I knew he'd stop me at the gate and say, son, I love you too much. But he didn't. And that was the last chance that he had, because I got to the beach and all my friends went, no shit, you were radical last night. Now, if you look at anybody's attributes in high school, there's athletes, scholars, guys with good cars. I was just radical. What does that mean? Well, I was unpredictable, you know, but I was a lot of fun at a party most of the time. Through the rest of my high school career, I liked fast cars, fast women, and didn't date Judy, and I drank all the time. And I ran around with guys that made me look okay. And I was a senior in high school. I had a 409 Chevy, fastest car I ever had. I mean, that there was more horsepower in that car than the last 10 cars I've had. Drank all the time. By now, we had switched to Red Mountain wine, $1.49 a gallon, not a grape in it. And I had a pickup truck since my parents moved often, and I was drunk by noon, and my friends go, hey, RB, you got to cool it. We got a party tonight. Now, I had run amok of the Newport police in the past, all the same. At the time, Newport Beach had one judge, Judge Duncan, and he had me on a drunk driving in private property, and I got on it in a dune buggy, and they stopped me right at Superior before I crossed over because I know it would have got away. And in my keen alcoholic mind, I looked up a case where there had been a guy in his self-propelled lawnmower and drunk as a lord mowed down his neighbor's roses. And they couldn't give him a drunk driving because it was private property. So I explained that to Judge Duncan, and he just pointed that way. Imagine his glee the next 2 weeks later when I was in on drunk driving on Superior. And this time he said, well, how nice to see you again, Mr. Alexander. And he sentenced me actually he cut me a break because he let me wash police cars and gave me one chance to either join the United States service or I would join his system. And as I walked out, he said the most curious thing. He said, Mr. Alexander, you'll be free from my custody at 6 o'clock on Sunday, but I have a feeling looking at your record that you're gonna be a prisoner of alcohol the rest of your life. Or until you address it. And I sat in my car with a bottle of vodka, and I thought, what is he talking about? And surely enough, a letter came not too long after that saying, greetings. And off I went into the Army at the age of 17. And I woke up with a rather large man of color looking me in the eyes, and I'm from Newport Beach, so I didn't interact with people. I didn't understand anything. And Sergeant Buford Berry, about 280 pounds and not a pound of fat on him, said, Alexander, I'm either going to break your back or I'm going to break your spirit. And I went, wow. And all the respect I didn't have for the Catholic Church and the police and the judges and anybody, I got. But I was 17, and I surfed, and I was in pretty good shape, and I had very, very low blood pressure. And so as it turned out, I excelled in all this stuff. I became a very good marksman because I breathed so slow. Not today, but most days. I could run faster than anybody else. And I was 17, for Christ's sake. But the Army has this battery of one test, and the answer in the 60s is you're an 11 Bravo, light weapons infantry. But they like to test you anyway, and if you're really challenged, you get to hump ammo. And after that, no. It actually takes a little bit of smarts to get into the combat arms. The next to the last test was the OLI, which is the Officer's Leadership Inventory. They asked me to leave the room because it takes 2 years of college to become an officer in those days. And around the corner comes Sergeant Barry. He'd been watching me. He's an E7, pulled a lot of water. He says, let the boy take the test. And I took the test, and then I took the officers, entrance exam to officers' candidate school, which was not like the SAT. It was, you know, do you like to camp? Are you afraid of loud noises? That kind of stuff. And once again, my alcoholic mind, even though it's starting to form a way that there's no way I'm going to Vietnam. That is a meat grinder. I want nothing to do with it. And I said, if I go to OCS, I might get a way out. I go to OCS. I go get a waiver. Youngest officer ever commissioned in the United States Army. And off I go into OCS 6 months. And once again, now I'm really younger than these guys. And I'm going, this is great. And I'm doing well and better and better and better, and I graduate the top of my class. Now, if you graduate honored, distinguished graduate of an officer candidate school, you're offered an RA commission, which is regular Army, which meant they can't riff you. You stay in. And everybody wanted that. But there was another little thing that was on the that nobody took, and that was if you didn't take an RA commission, you were given your choice of schools and your choice of assignments. I found out the longest school the Army had, because I only owed them 2 years. And it was EOD, so it was an Army-Navy school in Indian Head, Maryland. So I said, great. And then I found out I called this lady, and I said, where are they least likely to send officers to Vietnam? She said, well, we just moved the 9th Infantry out of Fort Lewis. That would be Fort Lewis. So I went back to them, and I said, you know, I'd really like to serve my country as an EOD officer and see the Pacific Northwest. I didn't like loud noises. I still don't. And I ended up going to EOD school and being sent to Fort Lewis, Washington, where once again I had outsmarted the entire United States Army. Now, I had a job that people dream about. I was the ammo officer for the post. I had a Jeep and a driver. Now I'm 18. I'm a second lieutenant. I report to a colonel that should have retired at the end of the Korean War. Every time I go to headquarters once on a Friday, put in my report, and done. I only owed 6 months, then a year, and if you're within that year, they cannot deploy you to Vietnam, to RVN. I had it made. I had a BOQ. Things were looking good. I had outsmarted the whole Army, and I started going to the officers' club to celebrate my wiseness. And I kind of let my hair grow, and my attitude kind of creep back on me. And the only official thing I had to do, but I already had it made, they weren't going to send me to Vietnam, was commander's call. And that is January 1st, where all the company grade officers visit the deputy post commander, which is a 2-star, or a 1-star, and then the field grade officers all go to the post commander. I show up in my dress blues, the only time I ever wore them, and they are kind of snappy. They're blue, and they got the epaulets and the whole deal. I thought I looked great. And you're supposed to go in through the reception line, put your card in a silver tray, shake hands with the general, have a drink, and leave. Now, a captain told me the next morning that the last time he saw me, I was extremely drunk. I had my arm around General Ashworth, and I was telling him how much I liked Fort Lewis and what I thought we might do together to make it nicer. That next Tuesday, I was on a cargo plane to Panama. So he not only sent me to Vietnam, he sent me to Ranger School. So when I got to Vietnam, the first cav went, God, look at this guy. You know, we are running out of lieutenants, and look at this guy. So within days, really months, of me having the Army outsmarted, I'm walking patrols in Vietnam with a recon unit called, I was a Blue Platoon leader because the other one had been killed. And if it hadn't been for an E7, thank God for the NCOs in this world, I took him aside and I said, Sergeant, don't let this bar fool you. I'm not a career officer. I do not want to die in this jungle. And if you teach me how to fight, I don't care if it says jungle expert or whatever it says, I don't know one end from the other. I said, if you teach me how to fight in this jungle, I'll have to make the call. But if you teach me, I'll listen. And he did. And for 4 months, he taught me. And I went on through that year and through all the things that you would imagine that can happen to any soldier in combat. And toward the end, I lost it. But I had become exactly what they wanted. You know, I had become a cold, efficient killer. And I had 50 buddies with me. And we were damn good at what we did. But I didn't want anything to do with it. And when I got out, just like the other gentleman said, 72 hours after being in a firefight in Tainan province, I had an exit physical. And they said, Captain, if I were you, I'd take my uniform off. And I went, wow. And I went back, finished college, and I tried to pretend it didn't happen, you know? And I picked up my bags at the airport, and I picked up my disease. Except now, I was a hero. I had a right to drink. The world owed me a living. And so I drank and partied and drank and partied, and it went on and on. Until it finally caved in. And at the ripe old age of 29, I almost drowned surfing. I was married, one kid on the way. And I was a failure. Even though I had a business going, I was a failure in every category of my life. I wasn't even 30 years old and I was ready to die. And I washed ashore at a place called Crystal Cove, and the lifeguard asked, what's your problem? What happened? And I said, I'm drunk. And he was an angel. He was a member of our group. And rather than send me to Hogue Hospital to have my stomach pumped, he had me sent to the care unit. And there my sobriety began. Not immediately. I gave you a good run for your money because I slipped 12 times in my first year. And they said, you know, you need a really hardcore sponsor. And they mentioned this Lynn W. guy. And I said, not me, boy. And there I'm running a retail store, and just like those old American Express cards, in comes this guy with these pants that should have been outlawed. And I go to use his, evidently he had a small anger problem, kept throwing these Dunlop Max Plies over the tennis courts, and I kept selling new ones. And it goes, J. Linwood W. And I looked and I went, because I'm struggling. And I said, I think I need to talk to you. And we went across the street to a restaurant and talked. And my sobriety started. And he was loved me enough to let me almost die. And the biggest fear, I've been in combat, and I'll get to that, how that all came about. But even in the worst combat I was in, I was never as frightened as I was driving to the meeting September 17th, 1980. Because I asked Lynn if I could go to meetings in El Toro or Long Beach or anywhere, but not Laguna. They're sick of seeing me pop up as a newcomer. In his own dear, loving way, he goes, Alexander, goddammit, he goes, why don't you try a little honesty? He says, you've tried everything else. I think I've got that right. And I drove to that meeting with tears running down my face because I thought, I'm the one guy that this isn't going to work for. I'm going to die drunk, like my dad. And I sat in that meeting, and when it came time for newcomers, I said, the only true prayer, I mean, I made a few of those deals in Vietnam, you know, get me through tonight and I'll be good. And he was and I wasn't, but I didn't believe. I did not believe. But that moment, I was at the point that I hope all alcoholics can get to. I was out of ideas and I was willing. And I said the lamest prayer, but I said, if you're there and I don't think you are, I need help now. And Johnny Ackland was leading the meeting, and there must have been 10 newcomers that night. And I stood up, but something changed when I stood up. Something changed. And at the end of that meeting, Johnny A. at the time was wearing these giant glasses that he would take off and put on for dramatic purposes. And I was not the only newcomer. And he goes, you there. And everybody stops and looks at me and he goes, "You come back next week and we'll talk more about sobriety." So I'm driving home, crying. And I'm going, "That old bastard doesn't think I can do it." And I'm going, "Shit, I don't think I can do it." At my heel, where I always was a half pint of Smirnoff vodka. Well, it was Popoff. I was having a hard time. And there used to be a trailer park called Treasure Island, where now is a beautiful resort. And I pulled over. God had me pull over. And I carefully threw that bottle out, because I knew an alky'd want it. And I drove home that night, and I actually went to sleep. My wife said, something was different. I woke up that morning. Now, I didn't jar awake at 4 o'clock with a committee going, "Boy, are you screwed." I awoke, and the magic had happened. I was driven to my knees by the feeling of the absence of my obsession to drink. And due to, you know, my sponsor's training, I didn't even stand up. I went right to my knees, and I said, "I have no idea what's happened. But could I keep this today?" Now, when I started my morning this morning, almost 34 years later, I started my day on my knees. Because the magic I've had, the life I've had, is a gift from a power that can't come from this earth. And my son almost died in Iraq and is now coming up on 5 years in this program. And the thing is, I've followed my sponsor's directions and I've lived a life that none of my parents. I walked my daughter down the aisle. I've been in business. I'm not currently in the Army. I work for Forcecom as a GS-13, and I work for a dollar a year. That's my way of giving it back. And I meant to say that the generals, when they gave me the hatchet, you know, "We'd give you more because of some of the things we feel are heroic that you've done. But we can't give you a medal because you're not supposed to be here." And I told him, "I'm no hero. The heroes died." And they did. But this program handed me a life that's allowed me to be a good husband, a good father, a good brother, and a good friend. I had no skills whatsoever. And when this Captain Funk, now a three-star general, was going into OIF-2, they were, the first cab was a heavy tank unit, and they were going to be doing MOUNT, which is Military Operations Urban Terrain. And they kept sending these people. You may have heard as Private Jessica Lynch was captured. Well, her M16 jammed, and I know why it jammed. General Funk, and they kept sending these guys called Lars from Remington, from Colt, from FMNMI to go to fix the weapons, but these guys were overweight, out of shape, and had no combat experience. They were getting killed. So they're going in with this division, and he goes, "Wait a minute, we've got to do this differently. Let's send a guy with combat experience, train him up on the weapons again." And he goes, "I know just the guy." He goes, "They couldn't lay a glove on this guy." And that was the only thing I was famous for was, no, they'd shoot people all around. They just couldn't lay a hand on me. And I knew I wouldn't die in that jungle. And they called me back to Fort Hood, and I talked to the soldiers, and General Corelli said, "God, he's telling them the same thing that's in the book, but it's not coming from the same source, so they're listening." Kind of like we talk to each other and say the same things that the judges and the doctors said. But guess what? They saw my CIB and they said, "Hey, this guy's telling us the truth." That's how we look into each other's eyes and realize, hey, they're not selling anything. They're telling us their story, the truth. And through something that could never happen again, I took a year off of my business and I was retrained in all the weapon systems of the United States Army. And then I was asked to deploy to Iraq, and I did. And my wife, you know, she said, "You know, you really want to go, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah." And she goes, "Well, stay on the bases and don't get in trouble." I said, "I got it." And she was to find out later that that isn't exactly how it turned out. But thanks to her Al-Anon program, I was able to be put in my place quickly. And I was allowed to re-see, kind of like John Glenn went to space again, I was able to see our American soldiers as they truly are. The heroes, the girls and the guys working 18 hours a day to help people they don't even know. The quality of our soldiers and sailors, Marines, Coasties, and Air Force is unparalleled in the history of armed warfare. Because not only are we the best, we've got compassion. But we pay, and all of us paid with some, but some paid with all. And as we approach this Memorial Day, yeah, I had some rather unique experiences. But the realization that I wasn't the hero and that my higher power was came from this program. Everything that happened from the time I was 29 on, the people I've seen, the places I've been, the ability to help others, every skill I have in this life was given to me by this program. And when tomorrow comes, all of us will face faces, not names, not the casualties were light, because some lost, they're not casualties or light when it's your, when you get the call. And I got the call. But my son survived by, thank God, the wounded warrior and the groups at Landstuhl saved my son's life. No parent should have to go through that, and some parents have gone through it twice, and yet this country is still willing to give and give and give. And the spirit of the American soldier is very much like the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I was in Vietnam or Iraq, I wasn't fighting for my flag. I was fighting for the guy next to me. And I'm not up here for me. I'm up here for us. Thank you very much.
This recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.